I sold most of my Vietnamese shares about 18 months ago, and more recently I've been buying again Vietnamese shares. Vinamilk, Vietnam dairy product, is in the consumer sector a relatively inexpensive company in Asia compared to, say, other companies in the same sectors in Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand. So I'm buying some shares in Vietnam, but I also have a very large portfolio of shares in Thailand, and I want to explain why.
Hi, you're listening to Antiloop, episode 129. My name is Michael Seeding. Today, I'm talking to the absolutely legendary Mark Faber. He's editor and publisher of the Gloom Boom and Doom Report. You can find out more on his website, www.gloomboomdoom.com. It's just $300 per year. The link is provided in the episode description. In June 1990, while I was at Stockholm School of Economics, he set up his own business, publishing a widely read monthly investment newsletter, the Gloom, Boom and Doom Report, which highlights unusual investment opportunities. And Futurist, the hedge fund that I used to work at, was a subscriber more than 20 years ago. Hi, Mark. Could you describe your mindset and the environment that led to the name Gloom, Boom and Doom Report back in 1990?
Yes. I mean, I started actually to write after I joined Wall Street in 1970. And I published already the first report in 71, which was what investors should do if the US dollar were to devalue. And then I kept on writing because I wasn't very happy with the research provided by Wall Street that was always bullish, and they never published negative reports. And then when I started my own business, after I had worked for Wall Street firms for 20 years, first for White Weld and then for Drexel Burnham Lambert, I started my own business, and I lived at the time in Hong Kong, where I had moved to in 1973. So I was looking for a title of the report, and I thought, in the environment that we had at that particular time, where half the stock market capitalization in the world was the Japanese stock market, that there were opportunities in doom, in other words, Japan going down, and there were opportunities on the long side, in particular at the time in Russia. And then also early on, we had discovered many opportunities in Asia, in the Philippines, in Thailand, Indonesia, and in Chile, in Argentina and Brazil, and also Colombia. So we're an early investor in Latin America because through the high inflation that America had experienced in the 70s, stocks had become dirt cheap. In 1986, the Argentine stock market had a market value of $700 million. That was for the whole country. So stocks were very, very inexpensive. And then I kept the name because wherever you look in the world, there are always some stocks that are high and there are stocks that are low. And there are some investments that are high, properties as an example, and other things that are inexpensive, like commodities or so. So there's always something to buy and always something to avoid.
Yesterday, I dug out a few of my physical copies of your Gloom Boom Doom newsletter. I actually erroneously called it a faxed issue when I was talking to your assistant, but I now realize that these were actually snail mailed as true physical, like small booklets. And I picked out a few issues from 2004 and onwards, and they say things like reflation, Goldilocks, good deflation. So it seems as if, as you say, nothing changes. So the name of the the report, it definitely holds water still. And to talk about one of these issues, de-dollarization, we're still at that topic now. What do you say about that?
Yes, it is clear that the U.S. dollar over time will lose its importance. It is largely a function of U.S. Politicians who have adopted a very aggressive foreign policy in terms of expropriating or freezing assets of other countries. So if you have the leading currency in the world, the reserve currency, as we call it, and there is a threat, say I'm India and you are Russia and someone else in the room is China, and there's the threat that one day our foreign exchange reserves, which we hold with the U.S. Federal Reserve or U.S. banks, that they will be frozen, our appetite to hold these assets diminishes. Number two, if you look at the history of Rome, basically Rome had a hold on the Mediterranean until about the year 250 AD. And the trade was controlled by Rome at the time. But gradually, countries started to trade with each other outside the Roman system. And this is nowadays also the case that more and more countries, say Saudi Arabia, their largest trading partner now is China. So they sell oil to China, and China invests in Saudi Arabian projects and infrastructure and so forth. So these transactions are increasingly settled outside the US dollar. So over time, the US dollar will of course lose its importance, but it doesn't happen overnight. But who knows, if we move into a hostile geopolitical environment, the US could make it difficult, for instance, for you as a Swedish citizen. You hold a portfolio of stocks, you hold some US shares, and the US government wouldn't think twice about saying, well, you can sell your shares, but you can't take the dollars out of the US. That would not surprise me. That's going to happen one day.
Do you have any kind of time horizon for a likely phase change in the dollar hegemony?
That I don't know, but I know that, say, when I came to Asia in 73, China consumed 2% of global commodities, and now it consumes approximately 50%. And the Chinese economy at the time was insignificant. Hong Kong alone was 27% of the Chinese economy. It's one city, a small city. So it shows how small China was. Now the Chinese industrial production is larger than the one in the US by about a third, and they produce more cement than the rest of the world combined. You understand, we're no longer talking about a small country. It's a huge industrial power. And with that, the role of the US dollar has diminished already.
You say that your focus is on unusual investment opportunities. Do you what kind of unusual investment opportunities do you see right now? And what do you actually mean by unusual? I can see that maybe they are unusually long term or have unusual potential, for example.
Well, if you look at markets, what is not unusual is for people to buy technology stocks. That's why you have very high valuation of anything to do with technology or artificial intelligence and so forth. And then you look at other investments which are grossly neglected and avoided, and partly also avoided because of regulation, ESG, and all the nonsense that comes along with it. So I can give you a list of markets that are, say, relatively inexpensive and would fit the criteria of unusual at the present time. One of the most hated investments at the present time are Chinese stocks and Hong Kong shares. I am aware of the problems associated with these investments, but I can say that they are very depressed at the present time. Other markets that are out of favor and may now become in or may be discovered are Pakistan, Nigeria, Kenya, Sri Lanka, Brazil, Colombia, and Argentina. And then one of the most hated sectors are South African gold mines. So here you have stocks that are very depressed. Some will never move and some will move down. But the ones that move up may be moving up a lot. Like a year ago, at the beginning of 2022, the most favorable viewed market by foreigners was Vietnam. What happened? The market dropped 41%. The market that was hated the most was Turkey. And when I wrote about Turkey, I had Turkish readers write to me and say, how can you recommend Turkey? We have inflation around 80% and this and that. And I said, yes, you're right. Everything is bad, but that's why the market is inexpensive. And what happened? The Turkish market in 2022 went up by approximately 100% in US dollars. Because whenever the currency collapses as a result of inflation, stocks become cheap in US dollars. And that had happened in Turkey, and this has happened now in Pakistan and Nigeria.
One of the issues that I dug out was about Argentina. And I think the issue was from 2004, and you recapped a little bit of what you had said about Argentina a year or two before. And that was also a case of the Argentinian stock market moving up by 270% in US dollar terms in like 1 or 2 years. So it's very easy to get frightened by the foreign exchange situation. You seem to focus on countries rather than sectors, or would you say that there are also sectors that are interesting in, for example, Europe and the US, or would you rather go for example, oil companies in Brazil rather than US oil companies?
Yes, this is a very good question, especially in the current environment, because as you know, we have in Europe the most disastrous bureaucrats that are running countries ever in history. These are bureaucrats, they have no interest at all to do something for the country. Their interest is to get elected and get into commissions, and so they can get higher benefits and salaries and so forth, and privileges. In my view, it has created in Europe and also in the Western world, America, Canada, Australia, the UK, kind of a tyranny of incompetent bureaucrats. You understand, the king of Sweden, if he messed up things very badly, his head was chopped off or he lost his job. So he had to he was personally responsible that Sweden would do reasonably well. Same in France, same in England, same in Spain and so forth. Not all succeeded, but in general, it's remarkable that if you look at the Roman Empire, which began after the Second Punic War or after the Third Punic War, 146 BC, and then it lasted another 500 years. It's remarkable that despite all the internal squabble, despite disastrous emperors, right at the beginning, Caligula and Nero, the empire lasted that long. But if you have bureaucrats such as we have in Europe, and you ask me once a question about what young people should do, I can tell you they must vote against the socialists and the Green Party. These are communists. They want to destroy the wealth that Europeans built up with their work, hard work, and with technologies and savings and frugality.
So do you think that they will succeed in their socialist experiment and their ESG measures and therefore limit the potential for example, miners and oil explorers in the Western world, in Europe specifically?
Well, what I wanted to say is that when you ask the question about do you select sectors or countries, I think the country selection is important nowadays. And my sense is that you're better off investing in emerging markets than in Europe. But I have some hope for Europe. And this is if the bear market continues in equities and stocks drop, say, another 30, 40, 50%, and the rich people lose money, then the rich people will wake up from their complacency and indifference and vote out the green and socialist communists. That is the only hope Europe has. and move away from being a vassal of the United States.
Do you have any good hope for this actually happening?
I'm always a hopeful person. I'm an optimistic person. I ride motorcycles in Thailand.
Yeah.
I'm optimistic, but I think it has to get much worse. And you see, I was educated in Switzerland in a private school. The people that went there were affluent students or had affluent parents and so forth. And I have still contact to the more affluent class of people in Switzerland. I am on the committee of an initiative for neutrality in Switzerland to move people and the sign that Switzerland should incorporate more articles in the constitution about neutrality. I tell you, it's very difficult because people are complacent. But you can pay. If you pay, there are agencies, they will collect signatures. It costs about $5 per signature, but you can collect them. This is also an aberration of democracy that if I have money, I can hire, say, an agency and they collect 100,000 signatures for me and I launch an initiative about something. The socialists are very good at collecting money, especially from American NGOs.
Yeah, well, their thing is organizing. I've actually driven motorbikes in Vietnam. Which would you say is worse, Thailand or Vietnam?
In Vietnam, they drive slowly. There are lots of motorcycles, but the traffic in Ho Chi Minh and in Hanoi moves at about 30 miles an hour. It's very regular. In Thailand, you have endless armies of drivers who have no clue about driving because they never took a license or they bought their license.
And where would you prefer to invest right now? You mentioned Vietnam was a hotspot a year or two ago, but now it's come down. So which one is more interesting?
Well, I've been investing in Vietnam since 1989 when we built our first hotel there. And then we built a series of hotels on China Beach between Da Nang and Hoi An. And I also had a Vietnamese portfolio since about 2002-2003. I sold most of my Vietnamese shares about 18 months ago. And more recently, I've been buying again Vietnamese shares. Now, as elsewhere, there are shares and shares. So some will go up and some will go down. But as an example, Vinamilk, Vietnam dairy product, is in the consumer sector a relatively inexpensive company in Asia compared to, say, other companies in the same sectors in Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand. So I'm buying some shares in Vietnam, but I also have a very large portfolio of shares in Thailand, and I want to explain why. In a world which is uncertain, and some of my educated friends, including educated Americans, because they also exist, they're very rare, but they do exist, they think the world is headed into World War III. I am more hopeful, but it is possible. The U.S. wanted war with Russia. They got it. They may want war with China for no reason, but they may want to war. And if that happens, all hell will break loose. And when I mean hell will break loose, it may mean that if you have, say, a portfolio of securities with a Swedish bank in Sweden or a Swiss bank in Switzerland or a UK bank in the United Kingdom, that you won't be able to transfer money from these institutions to Thailand. So I have the view that you should have a diversification in stocks, bonds, commodities, precious metals, cryptocurrencies, whatnot. But also you need a geographical diversification. In other words, you are Swedish. You don't want to have all your money in an American bank, in a British bank, in a Canadian bank. The chief vote in the world is Mr. Trudeau, and in Australia. This is one country, the American NATO empire. For me, it's unbelievable that Sweden wants to join that empire. But anyway, that's their decision. decision, not mine. But you have to have assets. Say, I wouldn't have any assets in the US. Some people want to have assets in the US, but you could have some assets, say, in Canada or Australia, and you could have assets in the UK and in Switzerland or Sweden or France or Italy, and some in India and some in China and some in Hong Kong and some in Singapore, okay? And some in Brazil. That's why I like Latin American markets, because in a World War III scenario, they are removed from the war theater. The war theater will be US-Russia and US-China. In other words, Southeast Asia, Taiwan, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And what are some
I'm in a vulnerable zone, because I'm between China and the southern coast of Thailand and Vietnam.
So what's left then is Latin America and Africa, but Africa is becoming vassal states to China, maybe. So Latin America it is. And there you have like immense natural resources, including minerals and food.
Yes, I agree. I mean, people have complained, and right, of course, the Western media, which is left-leaning. So they always write about China colonizing Laos and Cambodia and so forth. But better to have to build railroads from China to Bangkok and on to Singapore than to carpet bomb these countries. That's what the US has done. Carpet bomb innocent countries, innocent people. And then the Western journalists, they come and accuse the Chinese of colonizing these countries. Well, better colonize it like the Chinese do than like the Europeans did in Africa and the Americans in Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam.
What's your view of some of the long-term trends? I mean, there are a lot of people talking about fourth turning, and you have Ray Dalio with his New World Order talking about like these coming 10 or 20 years there are going to be like enormous change. How do you view these things?
I have early on written extensively about long-term business cycles, and this was the subject of some of my books. And I also then wrote about war cycles and so forth. And of course, cycles do exist. Can you measure them? No, but they do exist. So let us look at, for investors, a very important cycle. And this is the cycle of inflation and interest rates. So we had, after the Second World War, 1942, 1945, a low in interest rates and a low in the rate of inflation. And then there was a rising tendency of inflation, which then began to accelerate in the late 60s and further accelerated in the 70s and peaked out in, say, 1980. The interest rate cycle followed. Interest rates on 10-year treasuries were like at 4% in 1960. They were at 6% in 1970. And then they rose to over 15% in September 1981. This is a milestone in economic and financial history, the high in inflation in 1980-81. And thereafter, we have a period of disinflation and declining interest rates. And as a result of that, we had the stock markets in the world, which in 1982, in the case of the US, 1982 was no higher than in 66. In other words, 16 years later, take off. So stocks went up, bonds rallied, interest rates fell. And this cycle, which was favorable for financial assets and assets in general, lasted, in my view, until August 2020, when the 10-year US Treasury touched, artificially produced by the central bank, 0.59%. Okay? So went from over 15% in 81 to 0.59%. And now we have inflation moving up and we have interest rates moving up, but irregularly. In the 70s, we had already 12% treasury bond yields in 1973, and then they fell to less than 5%, to precisely 4.77% in 73. 76. And then they went up again and fell again and up again to the peak in 1981. So there are big swings in asset prices during that time. And this is what I expect in future.
So bouts of inflation that create economic problems, and then the recessions pull inflation back down again, and then it starts over again, and it goes like that for years and years, like in the 70s, something like that.
The inflation is not the problem. The problem is the government. Inflation is a tax. The inflation comes about because of fiscal deficits that are largely financed by money printing. And this is the government that controls that. Of course, the government knows it's easier to have inflation than to increase taxation on ordinary people, and especially on the rich. Because the rich, they will always find ways not to pay taxes. So the government says, okay, we have deficits and we have inflation. And okay, inflation is bad, but the alternatives are much worse.
So how would you rank different asset classes in this environment? It sounds like anything real, including gold and soft commodities, should fit the bill.
Yes, this is true. And it was true in the 70s. Farmland was good. Gold, silver performed well, and diamonds.
Where do you see gold right now? Is there any comparison you can make? I mean, gold rallied quite well between 2000 and 2011, and then came back down. And so is this kind of a mid-cycle pause we're in right now, or how do you see it?
Well, I'd say in 1970, you could buy an ounce of gold for $30, okay? And in 2015, you could buy an ounce of gold for $1,000. And now it is around 1900. I think anyone who doesn't hold any gold is crazy. How can you trust our governments? How on earth would you trust governments who can print money not to print money? They're going to print money. And the Swedish currency will continue to go down over time. And the US dollar, its purchasing power will diminish over time. In Europe, we have precise statistics. In the last 2 years, real wages have gone down. Then the government publishes, the economy is expanding. Nonsense! The typical household today is not as well off as 3 years ago.
Actually,
this is the reality. Governments are an institution for lying. Nothing is true what they publish. Nothing.
We actually have an interesting solution to the whole weak Swedish krona problem. Right now we are discussing joining the euro to solve the problem. What do you think about that?
Well, the euro wasn't exactly a strong currency. And we have the same issue in Switzerland. The socialists always want to join the euro and the EU, because then they can go into commissions and so forth. And there's massive corruption in the EU. So a lot of money flows between the politicians and here and there. I'm, of course, very strongly opposed to that. If I look at Ursula von der Leyen, at Miss Annabella Baerbock, and Habeck, this is a horror show in Germany. These are not politicians. This is a horror show. And that we would want to join this association with Biden at the top. They are dictating the policies in Europe to a large extent. This is about the last thing I would wish to do in my life.
Another asset class, actually, because now we've talked about monetary problems and politicians, whatever they tend to do with printing money and using budget deficits. But we also have actual real assets like critical raw materials used for electrification and also traditional energy like oil and gas. So just elaborate a little bit on that.
Well, I think that in the trend of ESG and so forth, oil stocks have been sold, and there's some oil stocks that are extremely inexpensive. Even if oil doesn't go up, the dividend are high. So I find oil stocks attractive in China and also in Latin America. And I mean, even in Europe, if you look at, say, the resource companies, whether it's BHP, Glencore, Rio Tinto, they're not not expensive at the present time. So I think there is an opportunity there. You're not going to make a lot of money right away, but I think some of these stocks have a significant upside potential in case oil goes up. Now, if you are just 30% believer in World War III, I can assure you the one thing that will go up in World War III are commodity prices. Food, soybeans, corn, and sugar, and so forth, coffee, cocoa, and of course, energy. This is the industrial commodities like copper, and as you mentioned, the rare earths.
When I try to fit this into your gloom, boom, and doom framework, the way I see it is that currently oil and energy metals, battery metals, wind turbine metals, they are in the gloom state, but there is a huge potential boom. I mean, so my actual question is, do you in general right now see better opportunities for expanding your wealth rather than preserving your wealth?
Well, I'm an optimistic person, but I'm also a realistic person. At my age, how do you want to expand your wealth significantly? At my age, you think I'm no longer useful as a waiter, so I have to be a little more careful with my investments than when you're 20 and 25. But I think at the present time, and I'm not saying this is a good investment, but it may be a relatively good investment. I can get on a deposit of a year or on a treasury bill of a year, 5% in US dollars. Now, I'm negative about the US dollar and so forth, but I'm not of the view that it will collapse right away. And I'm not certainly not very optimistic about the euro, given the EU leadership. But if I can put my money at 5%, I'm quite happy. Now, I'm not putting all my money. I have properties in Thailand, and I have properties elsewhere, and I have stocks, a diversified portfolio, mostly in Asia. But I also hold European stocks and some Latin American companies, and I will increase the exposure to Latin America, as I said. And then I have these special situations, including Uzbekistan. But I also have bonds. I don't like bonds. I think they'll go down. But if I look at the performance of bonds and stocks in the 1970s. Stocks, although it was a horrible time for the stock market, returned with dividends included. In other words, the total return. They returned 7.8% per annum between 1970 and 1980. And bonds returned 7.2%, because the fallacy of people is to believe that when interest rates go up, everything is bad for the bond investor. But you understand, the maturity of your bond portfolio is very important. So let's assume you and I, we agree that over the next 20 years, interest rates will go up. And we have a bond portfolio of a maturity of, say, 3 to 5 years. Every year, we get the cash flow, okay? This cash flow in a rising interest rate structure can be invested at a higher yield. That's why the enemy of the bond investor is to be in high coupon bonds in a bond market rally. In other words, when interest rates go down, because the cash flow will be reinvested every year at the lower yield. So that's why I own bonds, but not as much. And I haven't bought bonds for 2 years now. But I'm thinking that in the high yield market, some value is emerging among high yield bonds. So let's say I could buy a bank in Argentina, and there's not so much dividend, but maybe a lot of capital gains, but I can buy the bonds on that bank, and they would yield, say, around 7-8%. So you understand, I always maintain a fixed interest portfolio, but at the present time, I have a lot of cash in the fixed interest allocation. And then, as I said, I have real estate and, of course, precious metals, and I always keep on buying precious metals, and I never sold any precious metals.
What I was getting at is that I actually see tremendous opportunities in a lot of places, except maybe tech stocks. So there is like buying gold now, at least compared to fiat currencies, seems like a wondrous opportunity. Silver as well, and all the battery metals. If anything comes to fruition, as people are talking about with terms of battery factories and electrical vehicles, there seems to be like a 10-year boom ahead. It's so surprising to me. Please fill in. But it's surprising to me to see tech stocks holding up so well this year, and there is such a gloomy sentiment over all the actual real stuff that everybody's talking about that we actually need for the coming 10 years.
Investors nowadays, most of them have very limited knowledge. Of course, they're advised by research analysts and so forth, but the research analysts haven't been very accurate either. But investors basically buy what moves. You understand? If I tell you Hong Kong shares are attractive, then the portfolio manager will say to me, yes, Mark, we agree with you, but there's no hurry to buy them because in a year's time, they may not be higher or even lower. To this, I respond, yes, you're right. But if I tell them buy Nvidia or Alibaba, they may buy it because it moves. And there's a lot of momentum playing in the market at the present time. I own, as an example, and I'm not saying it's the best in the field, but for my resource exposure, among others, I own Ivanhoe. I know the chairman very well and so forth. And he's super bullish about copper in the environment of ESG that we have and so forth. And I can see that copper will go up. But if I look at the market action, it's not acting well. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
So I hold the stock, but I'm not of the view that it will move right away. I prefer oil stocks with a cash flow and the dividend because as an investor, it has served me well to invest in high dividend stocks. If you're very smart, there are better ways to invest money. But if you're of average intelligence, like I am, then dividend stocks is a very good alternative.
Do you follow any particular indicators to inform you of long-term trends or wherever to invest your money? Like, for example, right now the Chinese yuan, it's very weak against the US dollar. A little bit surprising, perhaps, but some people say that that's a strong indicator of coming, or actually an indicator of underlying banking problems, and that's what's feeding into to the currency, and that spells a little bit of doom maybe a half year out.
Correct. I think most banks in the world have some problems. Most companies have some problems. Most people have some problems. The question is how much you pay for these problems, and I think that Chinese stocks, not all, but most of them are relatively attractive, and not all will go bankrupt. But the banking system is under stress, undoubtedly, because of the property market. Having said that, we have to analyze how much deposits the Chinese public has and how many debts they have. And when we do that, then the situation in China is maybe not as bad as the Western media claims. You understand? I want to make here a point, and this is whatever the Western world says, it will always be negative about Russia and China. China is the evil, and because of China, people have lost their jobs. Because of China, these factories had to close down, and the Chinese cheat, and the Americans are always honest. That is the world view of the dumbed down Western media.
Yeah, it's kind of the
this
mirror.
Is the sad reality. The media nowadays does no longer report facts, but fiction. And yeah, the reality is that China was very depressed and poor when they opened up in 1978. And they introduced essentially market reforms and the capitalistic system. Everybody in the world can see that under communism, they were impoverished and now they're relatively prosperous. prosperous. I'm not saying rich, but relatively prosperous. They can travel. In 2019, 140 million Chinese traveled outside the country. Anyway, the point is, for every Chinese, the standard of living has gone up. I can't say that for every Swedish person over the last 4 or 5 years, especially with the madness to let in so many immigrants. The point is, we have China, and the Chinese economy will never again grow at 8-9% per annum, for the simple reason that the population will shrink. And this is not my imagination. These are estimates by various universities. Not that I have a high opinion of universities, although I studied there, so I know it. But the population will decline. In the meantime, India will continue to grow. It will not overtake China economically, maybe never, but it will grow, and the economy is doing okay. So the per capita consumption of oil in India will go up, and the capital consumption of other resources. So there's a, we have in the world, the Western world, I mean Europe, there's no longer going to be much growth there, because the little growth will be torn down by rebellions and civil wars and torching of anybody who has property. This is the big threat in Europe, the destruction of wealth, of honestly earned wealth, by jealous people who came as immigrants and as refugees.
So where are you hiding out?
Not hiding out anywhere. I have lived in Hong Kong since 1973, and before that in New York. And after 1990, I kept my office in Hong Kong. I still travel regularly to Hong Kong. I think it's still a place with fantastic opportunities, especially in smuggling, in view of the sanctions and so forth. But I have a house here in Thailand, in the north, in Chiang Mai. There was a house in Vietnam.
So do you like the north better than the south, and why?
This is an individual view. Some people like the sea. I also like the sea, so I have a house on the beach in Vietnam. But I prefer the climate in the north, because we have four seasons. We have a winter time when the climate is cool, and in summer it's hot, but it's not humid. I mean, not humid when it's the rainy season. Of course, when it rains for 3 hours, everything becomes a bit humid. But it's not as humid as Singapore or Indonesia or Malaysia and the south of Thailand, Phuket, Hua Hin, and Pattaya.
All right. I have just a final topic on currencies, if you have the time. So one was just to continue on the thing with the currencies as indicators of what's coming. So, for example, you have the weak Chinese New Yuan, and you also have a very strong Swiss franc. Do you think these currencies are signaling something actually useful?
The Swiss National Bank, many years ago, I mean, we're talking about like 40 years ago, they commissioned a study about currency movements and returns on equity markets and so forth. And they found that in countries that had a weak currency, the returns on equities were higher than in countries that had a strong currency. And that there wasn't much to worry about when investing in equities, about investing in which country. I have a Swiss portfolio also, because I'm a Swiss patriot. I'm a nationalist, evil right-wing Swiss. But the return on my Swiss portfolio is not very high. I'm not even sure I made money. But I have some Swiss stocks because I have a Swiss passport. So in a disaster situation, I could move to Switzerland. I also have a Hong Kong ID card. But in a disastrous situation, they may not accept people moving into Hong Kong. During the Second World War, foreigners were evacuated from Hong Kong. Only the soldiers stayed back. And, you know, when people talk about the Chinese and Hong Kong in this negative light, I can tell you, there's a documentary about Hong Kong, which is only about 40 minutes or 30 minutes, but it's very good about the hardship Hong Kong went through repeatedly with epidemics, with the Second World War, and with the riots in 67 and so forth and so on. And that the city always bounced back is remarkable. So I went to Hong Kong recently and I had to laugh, because when you arrive at the airport from Thailand, you can see that everybody moves at 3 times the speed they move in Thailand.
Time is money.
Yes, very efficient. And they're very kind of, I asked the taxi driver how business was. Oh, he said very good.
The Swiss franc always used to be very strong right ahead financial crises. Just looking back, the last like handful of crises. So that might have been an effect of flight to safety, that somebody knew something beforehand. But nowadays, I mean, the Swiss franc and the central bank, it's like a hedge fund. They print money and they buy the tech stocks in the US. Maybe it's not a useful signal anymore.
Yes, I agree. And we have the socialists. We have, the country has moved radically to the left. And I am free to choose where to invest in the world. I used to have 90%, almost 100% of my assets in Switzerland. I'm now down to something like 40%, 30%.
What do you think about Bitcoin?
I think it will be the standard and it will, trade actively. Whether it will go up from here or down, that I don't know. But Bitcoin cannot be printed at the same rate as a central bank can print money. And my base case, also looking at who the central bankers are, is that they will print money and that they will continue to finance government deficits. And that as a result of that, and I have to point out, it is possible that over the next 6 months, the rate of inflation drops meaningfully. But then the central banks will claim, hoorah, we fought inflation successfully. Inflation was due to Putin, but now that it's gone, it's our merit that we brought down the rate of inflation. So let's print more money to stimulate the economy. You'll see.
Yeah, I'm getting conscious about your time, and it's been an hour, an absolutely lovely hour, and I'm so grateful to finally get to talk to you. Well, I like the messages, and I'm sure my listeners will too. So thank you so much, Mark Faber. Do you have any final words that you want to conclude with?
Not really, but I think that if I look at my life, and because I'm in this initiative for neutrality in Switzerland, I now see what the politicians are and what kind of despicable people they are. I think I should have gotten involved more in politics early on and voted more regularly against all measures that the socialists propose.
All right. That was Mark Faber, editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom and Doom Report. And there is a link in the episode description. Thank you so much, Mark.
My pleasure. Thank you. You have a nice painting on the wall. okay.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you. Cheers. Bye.
Remember that nothing we said in this podcast is supposed to be investment advice.
All investments are risky and you can lose all or parts of your invested capital.
Remember to do your own analysis and don't trust anything you hear on the streets.
Thank you for listening.